Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. You can access the website at www.askelm.com. That's askelm.com. And David Seeloff carries on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And right now we are working on a series called Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And we are beginning right now, Chapter 9. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. And so let's get right into it.
Yeah.
The title of this chapter is The Lunar Eclipse of Josephus, dealing with Chapter 9. And Dr. Martin writes, and I'm reading his words, it is not difficult to know which eclipse Josephus referred to if historians will do two things. First, they must eliminate unqualified lunar eclipses that could not be seen in Palestine from the period of 7 BC to early 1 BC. After that, the historical, archaeological, and chronological evidence must be evaluated that supports the eclipse that can properly conform to the evidence provided in the records, the historical and biblical records. Astronomy is the key to it all, and it is a sure guide to any chronology if one has documentation to provide a historical environment to utilize the evidence of astronomy. In the case of Josephus' eclipse, there is considerable historical and archaeological documentation to allow historians to pinpoint the precise lunar eclipse to which Josephus had reference, even in that dark decade in Roman history that we dealt with earlier in a previous chapter. In the last chapter, chapter 8, which was titled Astronomy and the Death of King Herod, it was shown how impossible it is to squeeze the events mentioned by Josephus from his lunar eclipse to the next Passover, that period of time, into a 29-day period that the March 13, 4 BC eclipse demands. There are further points that show that such an identification is contrary to reason. And let's look at a ritualistic requirement of the Jewish people that is fatal to the 4 BC eclipse. If the March 13, 4 BC eclipse were the one referred to by Josephus, we would have an impossible situation concerning an event on the Jewish calendar. The day of eclipse, of the eclipse, would have been Adar 15. That's one of the Jewish months, Hebrew calendar months. Adar 15. In the biblical book of Esther, it is recorded that the Jewish nation, in the time of Ahasuerus, King Esther, it is King of Persia. Let me start that sentence over. In the biblical book of Esther, it is recorded that the Jewish nation, in the time of Ahasuerus, King of Persia, ordained the 14th and 15th days of Adar as days of resting and rejoicing. The days were known as Purim, according to Esther 9, verses 26 and 32. Even Adar 13 was known as the Day of Nicanor. This was the day when the Jewish nation rejoiced in honor of the overthrow of Gentile domination back in the early Macedonian period. This was at the time of the defeat of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, immediately following these days were the two, this day of Adar 13 were the two festival days of Purim, of Adar 14 and 15. If March 13th, 4 BC, were the day of Josephus' eclipse, then it occurred that it must have occurred on the night of Adar 15, the second high day of Purim. Now, why should this be a problem? The truth is, it is a difficulty of major proportions. Josephus reported that a few days prior to the eclipse, two very important rabbis had encouraged some of the youth of Jerusalem to destroy a golden eagle which King Herod had placed over the eastern gate of the temple. This is, of course, at the true location of the temple and not on the Haram es-Sharif. These religious leaders, these two rabbis, had interpreted the existence of this eagle as being contrary to the law of Moses. In broad daylight, a number of young boys began to cut down the eagle. These Jewish youths were caught in the act, and about 40 of them were ordered to appear before Herod and the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of the nation, to answer for this outrage. The two rabbis who perpetrated the plan were especially singled out for judgment. Realizing the great popularity of these two religious leaders, Herod felt it was wise to move their trial to the city of Jericho and away from the capital at Jerusalem. King Herod himself was ill at the time, and since his winter home was at Jericho, he wanted to be in the warmer climate of the Jordan Valley to alleviate the effects of his illness. This was accomplished. The rabbis and the young men who assisted them were finally convicted of high criminal actions, which were sacrilege and sedition, while most of the young men were given milder sentences. The two rabbis were ordered to be burnt alive. Now let's take up the story as recorded by Josephus. He will bring us right up to that important eclipse of the moon about which we've been talking through several chapters. Josephus writes in Antiquities, Book 17, Numbers 164 to 167, quote, "They were found guilty of sacrilege against God therein, but the people, on account of Herod's barbarous temper, and for fear he should be so cruel as to inflict punishment on themselves, the people, said what was done without their consent. And it seemed to them that the perpetrators might certainly be punished for what they had done. But with Herod, he dealt more leniently with others, but he deprived Matthias of the high priesthood, partly because of this action, and made Joasar, who was Matthias' wife's brother, high priest in his stead. Now it happened that during the time of the high priesthood of this Matthias, there was another individual made high priest for a single day, that this very day which the Jews observed was a fast. The situation was this. This Matthias, the high priest, on the night before that day when the fast was to be celebrated, seemed in a dream to have sexual relations with a woman. And because he could not officiate himself because of this, Joseph, the son of Elamus, his kinsman, assisted him in that sacred office. But Herod deprived this Matthias of the high priesthood and burnt alive the other Matthias who had raised the sedition with his other accomplices. And that very night there was an eclipse of the moon," end quote, from Josephus. What has this information to do with the observance of our eclipse, erroneously assuming for a moment, that it was the one of March 13, 4 BC? The truth is, it is devastating to the argument. It seems that those rabbis would have been burnt alive on the Jewish day of Adar 14, the first day of the two high days of Purim. No court, unless completely illegal, would have had criminals executed, and certainly not rabbis, on the special day commanded in the Bible when the Jews, quote, rested, a day of feasting and a day of gladness, end quote. And this is in Esther chapter 9, verses 17 and 18. The whole nation would have been in an uproar over such a procedure. Now, note this important point. Josephus shows that the decision to execute the rabbis was made by the Supreme Court of the Jews. And though it appears that some of the judges, especially the high priest, were reluctant to sentence them, the court still made the decision to have it done. There can be no doubt of the legality of the whole affair. When some of the Jews, just before the next Passover, expressed their displeasure over the sentence and the execution of the rabbis, Archelaus, Herod's son, tried to calm their outrage by reminding them that their trial had been conducted and that the sentence had been carried out, quote, according to law, end quote. The entire affair was certainly accomplished in a legal manner. Severe punishment, such as a burning, was sometimes interpreted as allowed in the Bible for certain types of crimes. And this is in Leviticus chapter 20, verse 14, chapter 21, verse 9, and in Joshua 7, verses 25 to 26. Even the burning of criminals was judged acceptable in extreme cases. And the rabbis were charged with sedition and sacrilege, but were they executed on holy days? Now, executions were not performed on holy days. True enough, there was a belief in the 2nd century AD that one who rebelled against the court could be retained for execution in Jerusalem until one of the three festival periods. And this is in the Talmud, Sanhedrin 11, number 4. Since the Jewish people who lived in Palestine were expected to be in Jerusalem at those times, the criminal could be executed in the presence of the multitudes to fulfill Deuteronomy 17, verse 13. However, as Krauss has shown, the criminal was not to be executed during the festival itself, but immediately before, when people were gathering in Jerusalem. This is in Krauss, the Mishnah, Sanhedrin, page 302. The Gospel of John shows that such a time was the period when Jesus was crucified, before the Passover. Purim, however, was not one of the three pilgrim festivals that required all Jewish males to be in Jerusalem. Purim was a time of carnival and celebration by all the people throughout the land. It celebrated the former deaths of Haman the Agagite, who was an Amalekite tribe of Edom, and his 10 sons. This is in Esther chapter 3, verse 10 and 9:24. Thus, the deliverance of the Jews from enemies who planned their mass genocide throughout the entire Persian Empire during the Persian period. These days of Purim would have been a most unlikely time for any judicial executions among the Jews, especially on the first day of the festival itself. So there were no executions on Purim. Now, there's another reason why Herod would not have planned the executions of popular rabbis, very popular rabbis, on the high days of Purim. Such a procedure would have been counter to the biblical symbols of happiness and joy that governed that festival period. And note this. Herod, who was of Edomite ancestry, could easily have been linked, even in a racial way, to the Haman of old, a race that was a mixture of Edomite and Canaanite stock, according to Genesis 36, verses 11 and 12. What has this to do with King Herod? Well, from the Jewish point of view, very much indeed, King Herod was a descendant of the Edomites. The Jews could well have made capital of the fact that Herod was kin to the ancient Amalekites through his Edomite ancestry. And now, if the eclipse of Josephus were that of March 13, 4 B.C., King Herod would have been burning alive two prominent rabbis on one of the very days that Jews were celebrating their earlier victory over Haman, the Amalekite, from Edom. The ancient custom of the Jews was the burning in of an effigy of Haman at the close of the Purim festival. So the idea is that Herod would have been very careful not to use the idea of burning during this time of burning effigy of an Amalekite and an Edomite during Purim. The ceremony is mentioned in the Talmud in Sanhedrin number 64, and it was condemned by the Theodosian Code as being a symbolic attack on Christianity. This is sufficient evidence to show that the custom was widespread among the Jews and that its observance no doubt reached back to the time of Herod and much earlier. A document found in the Gediza at Cairo describes how young men among the Jews used to make a dummy of Haman and expose it on the rooftops for a few days before Purim. Then on the day of the festival, they would build a bonfire and burn the dummy and burn it among great merriment and jubilation.
Kind of like burning something in effigy.
Yeah, like, football teams would burn the opponent.
Yeah, it's sort of another form of witchcraft.
Basically, it's derived, but the Hebrew custom had nothing to do with witchcraft. So who knows where things derived from in this custom? Who knows? The same custom is reported by an 11th century scholar as having been current in ancient times among the Jews of Babylon and Edom. And this is in Theodore Gaster's Festivals of the Jewish Year. If the eclipse of Josephus were on March 13, 4 BC, then the two rabbis were burnt to death on the first day of Purim. The Palestinian countryside would have been strewn with countless bonfires during the day of Purim, with effigies of Haman being burnt on them. Are we to imagine that King Herod would execute by burning two popular rabbis in the period when those Hamans were being burnt? This would be similar to a foreigner now ruling the United States, a descendant of our former enemies, intensely hated by the population as King Herod was, now burning two of our leading and popular senators in public view on the 4th of July during the while the Declaration of Independence was being read in all our houses of worship. The Book of Esther was at that time being read in all the Jewish synagogues at Purim. Even King Herod would have been too politically wise to attempt such an affront, which all the Jews would have considered a clear violation of a festival ordained by God. And the festival of dedication is actually recognized in the New Testament in the Book of John. Further, King Herod and Haman can be symbolically associated in several ways. They both had 10 sons. And just as Haman had been one of the chief advisors of the Persian emperor in the 5th century BC, Herod was one of the two top friends of Augustus, the Roman emperor in the 1st century BC. Besides this, many Jews considered the existing Roman Empire at the time as the government of the earthly Edom, and Philo mentions this in some of his works. It even became common among Jews to believe that the original Roman people were the descendants of Edom. This is in Rashi's commentary on Genesis 27:39 and Numbers 24, verse 19. Herod would not have executed those rabbis at Purim. Look at what this would have meant to the Jews at the time of Herod. Here was Herod, who was an Edomite, according to Josephus' Wars of the Jews, Book 1, having been made king of the Jews by the earthly Edom, Rome. This would mean that both Edoms were now conspiring to rule the chosen people of God, the Jews. And note the outrage. On the very day of Purim, if the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC was the one of Josephus. On the very days of Purim, when the Jews were celebrating their deliverance from Haman and his 10 sons, the Edomite Herod, also a father of 10 sons, was burning alive two of the most holy men of the Jews at the time that bonfires all over Judea were burning effigies of Haman. The use of type and anatype was then a very common practice in prophetic interpretation by the Jews, as the New Testament and other Jewish literature attest. Such a coincidence of Herod with Haman would have been extremely dangerous to Herod's political position, and he would have been well aware of it. In other words, he would have laid low during this period of time and not stirred up comment, but let the people do their thing until it was over, and then he would, regain his authority. Well, the whole thing is unthinkable. Herod may have been without principle, moral principle, in regard to laws and customs when the need arose, but he was too wise a politician to risk the outcome of such an insult to the Jewish people, and a festival of God would have also been insulted while Herod was alive and in hopes of recovering from a sickness. And so given the circumstances, 2 or 3 days after Purim for the execution of the rabbis would have satisfied Herod. In other words, there was no need to execute them immediately. Besides, King Herod knew the eclipse was coming. They were quite easy to predict at the time. Livy, the Roman historian Livy, talks about eclipses were easier to predict. King Herod no doubt timed the execution of the rabbis to coincide with the eclipse that night. He would have told the populace that God himself would show his displeasure at what the rabbis did by darkening the moon, and many of the superstitious might have believed King Herod. But if the eclipse were that of March 13, 4 BC, the Jews would have turned the tables on Herod himself. The eclipse would have been interpreted as a censure of King Herod's killing of the two righteous rabbis during Purim, and thereby desecrating the sanctity of that holy period. The killing of the rabbis on the on the very days of Purim would have gained no advantage for Herod. In fact, it would have been a major political catastrophe for him to have done so. And there's a further invalidation of the March of the 4 BC eclipse. Immediately after the Passover following Herod's death, Archelaus, who was Herod's designated heir, started on his journey to Rome in order to have Augustus confirm him in his kingdom. When Archelaus reached the port city of Caesarea, Sabinus met him on his way to Jerusalem. Sabinus was the officer in charge of financial affairs for the province of Syria. There can be little doubt that Sabinus had just come from Rome. He certainly had not come from Antioch in Syria, which was the provincial capital. This is made clear in the narrative of Josephus. Note that when Archelaus heard that Sabinus was going to Jerusalem to place all of Herod's effects under imperial control, he immediately sent his trusted friend Ptolemy to Antioch, quote, urgently soliciting, end quote, Verus, who was the governor of Syria, to come to Caesarea in order to intervene with Sabinus. And this is in just book 2 of the Wars of the Jews. Verus then left for Caesarea, and as Josephus said, he had come in answer to the appeal made by Archelaus through Ptolemy, end quote. Upon arrival, Verus persuaded Sabinus that it was not in Rome's interest for him to go up to Jerusalem at that time to perform his responsibility. Hearing the appeal of Verus convinced Sabinus that it was better to remain at Caesarea for the time being. Verus then took a legion of soldiers, about 5,000 men plus auxiliaries, which also added up to several thousand, which he had brought with him from Antioch, and Verus, the governor of Syria, went to Jerusalem. He left the troops in the capital, and then he himself returned to Antioch. After Verus accomplished these matters, what did Sabinus do? Well, Josephus tells us, quote, "But after Archelaus had sailed for Rome and Verus had returned to Antioch, Sabinus moved on to Jerusalem and took possession of the palace." Well, all of these events tell us several things. First of all, Sabinus could not have had his residence with Verus in Antioch. Had this been the case, Verus would have already known of Sabinus' authority and would have talked with him about the best manner in which to accomplish his task. But the narrative in Josephus strongly implies that Verus did not know of Sabinus' intentions until Ptolemy informed him in Antioch of what was happening in Caesarea. The truth is, Sabinus had just come by ship from Rome. Some, however, might think that Sabinus may have been a resident of Beirut, a major city in the province of Syria, but this is an unlikely possibility. Why would the imperial financial officer for the province of Syria live in a city over 200 miles from the capital and out of reach of the daily affairs of the provincial government? The evidence supports the proposition that Sabinus had come directly from Augustus in Rome to take over temporary financial affairs of King Herod and King Herod's empire. Indeed, there is evidence to show that Sabinus had greater authority in financial matters than did the governor Verus himself. As soon as Archelaus sailed for Rome and Verus returned to Antioch, Sabinus went to Jerusalem and took over command of that legion. All of this is footnoted by Dr. Martin in regard to by Josephus. Yeah, one second here. I have to put the cat out.
Oh my goodness!
I had the door open, and she was bugging me. Okay, Sabinus. Had Sabinus not had authority directly from Augustus in Rome, the commanders of the legion at Jerusalem could hardly have let Sabinus take over control contrary to the express wishes of Verus, the governor. But Sabinus took over command of the legion and other auxiliary forces at Jerusalem. Even the Jews called the division of troops the Legion of Sabinus, according to Josephus. And indeed, when war broke out over some of the actions of Sabinus, this is right after King Herod died, Sabinus commanded all of the military operations. The point is that there, what Dr. Martin is leading to is there was a major war in Palestine before the 70 AD war. And it was big. It was a big war. Huge. The superiority of Sabinus is demonstrated in other ways. Had Sabinus been under the control of Verus, the governor of Syria would simply have sent a note with Ptolemy restraining Sabinus from going to Jerusalem. Moreover, Josephus shows that Sabinus sent reports directly to Augustus without submitting them to Verus in Antioch for approval. When Verus finally came to Jerusalem to rescue Sabinus and the Roman troops from Jewish insurgents, when war broke out in Jerusalem, and this was soon after Christ was born, by the way, Sabinus did not feel it necessary to report to Verus regarding his actions. As a matter of fact, Sabinus managed to take 400 talents of money with him for his efforts in Jerusalem. All of this good evidence that Sabinus was not a subsidiary of Verus in Antioch, but rather that he had come to Palestine directly from Rome with imperial authority to take the financial affairs of King Herod's kingdom in hand. Since this is the case, look at the impossible situation that this all places with the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC. Since Herod must have died about 2 weeks or so after the eclipse took place, this would have put his death about April 1st. The next event was Passover, which lasted from April 11 to 17 in 4 BC. Josephus informs us that Archelaus was on his way to Caesarea before the Passover ended. This means that Archelaus got to the port city of Caesarea about April 17th. And just before he was about to sail to Rome, Archelaus, Herod's successor, found Sabaeus sailing into Caesarea. Now for the problem. How was it possible for the knowledge of King Herod's death to have gotten to Rome 1,700 miles, sea miles away, for Sabinus to have discussed the situation with Emperor Augustus, which he must have done, and then for him to have sailed to Palestine, another journey of 1,700 miles, on very slow ships driven by wind and rowers, and finally meet Archelaus in Caesarea, all within a 16 or 20-day period? Well, this is an impossible scenario and situation. This point as well shows that the March 13th, 4 BC eclipse cannot be the one of Josephus that Josephus was talking about. Could all of the above events have occurred 1 year earlier in 5 BC? Remember, we discussed last time that there were no eclipses in 7 or 6 BC. There were two eclipses in 5 BC on March 23rd and September 15th. There was the March 13, 4 BC eclipse, which was, and then there were no eclipses in 3 BC and 2 BC. And then on January 10th in 1 BC, there was a total eclipse. Now, could all of the above events have occurred 1 year earlier in 5 BC? After all, there was an eclipse of the moon in March 23rd, 5 BC. This springtime eclipse, however, cannot be the one associated with Herod's death. There were still only 29 days between this eclipse and the next Passover. All of the impossible situations in which the 4 BC eclipse encounters are precisely the same problems that occur with this eclipse. And besides, early 5 BC for the death of King Herod plays havoc with all the chronological indications of Josephus combined with Roman records regarding the period of King Herod's death. Why, even modern scholars have to add an extra year to King Herod's reign of 34 years from Antigonus' death. Herod succeeded Antigonus, reckoning only 2 or 3 days of Nisan 4 BC as a whole year. And they do this to make any reasonable sense out of their calculations. An early 5 BC date would cause utter chaos in the records of Josephus. Several scholars have seen the absurdities in accepting either the March 13 eclipse of 4 BC or the March 23rd eclipse of 5 BC. Because of this, it has even been suggested that the eclipse of September 15th, 5 BC, is a better eclipse for consideration. And this is by T. Barnes, Journal of Theological Studies, in 1968. But there are major difficulties associated with this eclipse as well. Let's look at that for a moment. Scholars recognize that Josephus reckoned the years of Herod's reign from the Jewish springtime month of Nisan to the next Nisan in the following spring. In order to make any sense whatever out of Josephus' statements that Herod reigned 37 years from the time he was proclaimed king by the Romans and 34 years from the death of Antigonus, his immediate predecessor, they have to put Herod's death in the first 2 or 3 days of Nisan in 4 BC. And they reckon the whole year from Nisan 4 BC to Nisan 3 BC to the reign of King Herod. This is in Vermesh and Millar's The New Shurer. But if one puts Herod's death back in 5 BC, then the year lengths of King Herod's reign, as mentioned by Josephus, become altogether garbled, and in no way do they make any sense to the historian. Indeed, the September 15th, 5 BC eclipse is impossible for other reasons. If the eclipse of Josephus were that of 5 BC, September 15th, then the 7 months would have passed before the next Passover. 7 months are too long a period, far too long a period, for the intervening events to have taken place. Now note this point. Herod was at Jericho when the eclipse occurred near his death, just before his death. The city is a furnace in late summer, in the time of September. It is situated just over 800 feet below sea level, and its mid-September temperatures are extremely high. Why would Herod, who was uncomfortably ill at the time, subject himself to such oppressive conditions in the Jordan Valley when the pleasant environment of Jerusalem was so near? We're talking about 120 degrees in the shade in the summer, in the late summer in Jericho. Much like we hear of Iraq today. It might be added, however, that if the eclipse were in the depth of winter, that satisfies the 1 BC eclipse, one could easily understand King Herod's wish to be in Jericho, where it was comfortably warmer. This point alone renders the September 15th eclipse as improbable for consideration. Yet there's another factor that certainly overthrows it. Josephus said that on the very night of the eclipse, the high priest Matthias was deposed from office by King Herod. This Matthias had a pontificate of service for about 9 or 10 months. This is proved by Jakob Jeremias in his book Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus, page 162. The proof centers primarily on the fact that Josephus, or rather Nicholas of Damascus, who was eyewitness to the events and that Josephus is citing. They said that Matthias had been appointed to the high priesthood when the scheme of Antipater to kill his father, King Herod, was first discovered. Josephus records that there was a 7 month span from that time until Antipater returned from Rome to Jerusalem for trial. Within 3 days after Antipater got back to Jerusalem, Herod dispatched messengers to Rome asking Augustus' approval to have Antipater executed. The couriers would have taken no longer than 3 months to go to Rome and to come back. But a few days before, news came back from Augustus that Antipater could be executed. In other words, Augustus allowed King Herod to execute his son. A few days before the news came back, the eclipse occurred. Notice what these facts mean. Matthias the high priest was deposed on the night of the eclipse. So by adding the 7 months between the discovery of Antipater's plot, when Matthias was promoted to the high priesthood, and Antipater's arrival back in Jerusalem, plus the 2 or 3 months for the messengers to go to Rome and return to Herod, there was a period no longer than 10 months for Matthias' tenure as high priest, probably closer to 9 months. This may all seem technical and complicated, but the results of the inquiry help us very much in showing that the September 15 eclipse of 5 BC could not be the one referred to by Josephus. It would involve an impossible situation regarding the high priesthood of this Matthias. Indeed, this very Matthias was a very famous personality in matters dealing with the priesthood, and something happened to him during his priesthood that was remembered for hundreds of years afterward. Now, let's look at this remarkable occurrence. Josephus records a remarkable occurrence that happened during the time Matthias was the high priest. As we mentioned earlier, he had a dream prior to the day of the fast in which he dreamed he was sexually intimate with a woman. This rendered Matthias ritualistically unclean. In other words, no one could be sexually intimate, even with his wife, prior to conducting the sacred ceremonies of the Day of Atonement. Nothing like this had ever happened before in the history of the priesthood. The Sanhedrin had to make a decision about the matter. They determined that Matthias could step down from his office for one day. In the meantime, a relative of his was commissioned to perform the sacred duties on that fast day. They appointed Joseph, the son of Elamas, to stand in for Matthias. This incident was so unique in the conduct of temple ceremonies that it was talked about in the Talmud centuries later. It's talked about in Harioth 12b, Yoma 12b, and Megillah 9b in the Babylonian Talmud. And significantly, the Talmud records that the day of Matthias' disqualification was the Day of Atonement. This was the great fast day of the Jews commanded by the law. For example, see Acts 27, verse 9. How does any of this show that the September 15 eclipse could not be the one referred to by Josephus? Well, it's quite simple to disqualify it. If this eclipse were the correct one, it would mean that Matthias' pontificate ended on that very night. Recall that Herod dismissed Matthias on the day of the eclipse, and that his high priesthood lasted 9 or 10 months at most. To go backwards 9 or 10 months from September 15th covers a period of time in which no Day of Atonement occurred. The previous Day of Atonement would have happened at least a month or two before Matthias in 5 BC, before Matthias was appointed to the high priesthood. These clear facts of history are certain on this matter. This shows that the eclipse of September 15th, 5 BC, thoroughly fails as a candidate. You know, in reviewing all this material, I can't help but think that Dr. Martin must have used an Excel spreadsheet to keep all this stuff.
It's a lot of information, yeah.
And I don't know how he compiled it, much less put it all together, but I would have worked out some type of calendar program on Excel, you know, or a spreadsheet program, you know, with one, you know, Matthias' timeline, King Herod's timeline, Archelaus' timeline, you know, for all these different people who they did what on any particular day.
Yeah.
And then you could, I don't know how this was done, but as you can see, it's all laid out in Josephus and explained as well as he can. These are complex events by Dr. Martin. And anybody can go back and lay this out on a spreadsheet and see how all this stuff dovetails. The eclipse of Josephus had to have been that of January 10th, 1 BC. All of the events that we mentioned above by Josephus fit quite comfortably with this eclipse, and only with this eclipse, as we will soon show. There were 3 months from this eclipse, from the occurrence of that eclipse to the next Passover. The messengers sent by Herod to Rome at the end of Antipater's trial in the previous autumn, would have arrived back in Palestine to Herod in Jericho in 2 or 2.5 months, which is very reasonable. At the death of King Herod in late January, messengers immediately would have been sent to Rome to inform Caesar of King Herod's death, thus permitting Sabinus to arrive from Rome just after the Passover to secure to the imperial treasury the property of King Herod. Matthias would also have been available on the Day of Atonement in the previous autumn. In fact, everything fits beautifully in other ways. There is a Jewish document called the Megillah Tanit, which is called the Scroll of Fasting, though it records festival days also. It was composed initially not long after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This scroll mentions two semi-festival days during which no mourning period was permitted. One was Kislev 7. The month of Kislev corresponds in most years to our December. The other commemorative day was Shabbat 2. This month answers to our late January or early February. No one knows why these 2 days of fasting are commemorated, and yet they must have been days of joy. Days of feasting, not fasting. No one knows why these 2 days of feasting are commemorated, yet they must have been days of joy ordained before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Well, what did they honor? Well, an early Jewish commentator, who probably lived in the 7th century AD, wrote a brief remark to Kislev 7, December 5th. Quote, he says it was the day of King Herod's death, end quote. However, M. Moisey Schwab, who studied the information about the scroll very extensively, felt that this was really the second of the days. In other words, Shabbat 2, January 28th. And this was the actual day commemorating King Herod's death. And interestingly, this latter date fits remarkably well with the January 10th eclipse of Josephus in 1 BC. King Herod's death on this very day would have occurred 18 days after the eclipse. All of the information in Josephus about Herod's activities between the eclipse and his death fits nicely with the chronological facts. Indeed, even the earlier date of Kislev 7, which was December 5th in that year, which the commentator associated with Herod's death, may have also a relevance to it. Look at what could have happened on that day. This could have been the time when the two rabbis, who were later executed, provoked the young men to tear down the golden eagle from the eastern portal of the temple. Such an occasion could well have inspired some commemorative date in which it was accomplished. In fact, this is the thing that Josephus reports. Those rabbis were, as Josephus states, quote, two of the most eloquent men among the Jews, and most celebrated interpreters of the Jewish laws, and men well beloved by the people because of the education of their youth. For all those who were studious of virtue frequented their lecture every day. Josephus mentions this in his Antiquities. They urged their students to tear down the eagle, which they considered idolatrous, in order that, quote, lasting fame and commemoration, end quote, would be afforded them and their pious act. And interestingly, the reason why the Megillah Tanakh was composed in the first place was to put aside days for, quote, lasting fame and commemoration, end quote. It may well be that the day on which the golden eagle was torn down, and also the day of Herod's death, were recorded in the Megillah Tanakh for commemoration, because on that very day was when the cry went out throughout Jerusalem that, quote, the king was dead. Though the report was false, it prompted the young men to storm the east wall of the temple and in full daylight cut down the golden eagle. Since the Feast of Dedication was fast approaching, a festival commemorating the overthrow of idolatry in the time of the Maccabees, the two rabbis could well have incited the youths to destroy the Golden Eagle at that very important period of time, since they were teaching that it was now, quote, a very proper time to defend the cause of God, end quote. Once again, quoting Josephus. Then what happened? The youths were rounded up, and the two illustrious rabbis who instigated the destruction of the eagle were brought before King Herod. But strangely, Herod decided not to bring them to trial in Jerusalem. He had their trial transferred to Jericho. The principal reason that Herod did this was no doubt because of his ill health, and he needed to be in Jericho. He then ordered that the Sanhedrin should meet together with him at that desert oasis. A quorum of the Sanhedrin allowed Herod to followed. A quorum of the Sanhedrin followed Herod to Jericho, and the trial in which the two rabbis were condemned took place. Now the Megillah Tanakh records an unknown fast day, not a feast day, but a fast day, for commemoration. It was Tabeth 9, which was the 6th of January in 1 BC. This could very well have been the day the rabbis were tried and sentenced. And 3 days later, on Friday, January 9th, the rabbis were burnt alive to correspond with the lunar eclipse that was predicted for that night. Delaying their execution on the eve of the eclipse, and especially since there were no biblical festival days involved as with the March 13, 4 BC eclipse, this would have allowed Herod to tell the superstitious people in Palestine that even God himself was frowning on the sacrilegious deeds of the two rabbis, and that God would express his displeasure that night with an eclipse. Herod would have died 18 days later on Shabbat 2, which was January 28th, and as mentioned before, this date is one of the undesignated festival days of the Jews mentioned in the Megillah Tanith, and it points to the time of Herod's death, and this makes perfectly good sense. Just before King Herod died, he said, quote, I know that the Jews will celebrate my death by a festival, end quote. And Shabbat 2, as well as Kislev 7 for the tearing down of the eagle, and Tabeth 9 for the sentencing of the rabbis, fit the historical timetable perfectly. Also, the events that Josephus said happened between Herod's death and the next Passover can be chronologically placed in a reasonable way. Now, only the eclipse of January 10, 1 BC, will work. Recognizing that the January 10th, 1 BC eclipse is the one mentioned by Josephus has much historical value in another way. Scholars have wondered for years why Josephus referred only to this one eclipse out of the hundreds that occurred over the generations that he covered in his histories. Why single out this one eclipse? Well, indeed, during the reign of Herod, there were at least 32 lunar eclipses visible in Palestine. 20 of them were partial eclipses, and 12 of them were total eclipses. 12 of them were total eclipses. There must have been special reasons for pointing out this single eclipse associated with King Herod's death, and indeed there were. There were special reasons. Other than the historical importance of Herod's death itself, it should be remembered that it was also the very day following the martyrdom of the two illustrious rabbis, whom the whole nation admired and esteemed. This was an important event for commemoration to the Jewish people. But there was a national event even more disastrous than that. The occasion of the rabbis' deaths led directly to the death of 3,000 worshipers the next Passover, being slaughtered in the temple precincts. This massacre, which was ordered by Archelaus, the successor to King Herod, resulted in the usual cancellation of all the Passover services, a requirement mentioned in Numbers chapter 9, verses 6 to 14. This was a most extraordinary event.
Now, the Edomites seem to be bent on solving their problems with murder and genocide.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think things have changed much.
Such a repeal of Passover, it was such a cancellation of Passover services because of 3,000 dead bodies within the temple precincts, was a most unique circumstance in the history of temple services. It made the temple unclean, so to speak. Of course, nothing like it had ever happened before. The suspension of this most important Jewish festival in the calendar of the Jews, like our government today forbidding the celebration of Christmas this year, would long have been remembered by the generality of the Jewish people. And yet there was another event associated with this cancellation of Passover that would have equally brought that year to special remembrance by the Jews. This slaughter of the 3,000 Jewish worshipers in the temple led directly to a major war between the Jews and the Romans that occurred the whole of the following summer and autumn. Josephus said that this war was no minor skirmish. It was the most significant conflict to occur in Palestine from the time of Pompey in 63 BC, when he took Jerusalem for the Roman Empire, up to the Jewish War of 66 AD, which started with and ended with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and actually continued to 73 AD with the conquest of Masada. In order to subdue this Jewish rebellion of 1 BC, the Romans had to muster three legions in Syria, plus auxiliary forces, about 20,000 armed men in all, to put down this rebellion that erupted. At the end of the war, 2,000 Jews were crucified and 30,000 were sold into slavery. This was a very serious war in Palestine. And what started it? Well, it was the death of the two rabbis associated with the eclipse of the moon near King Herod's death. This was one of the major reasons that the eclipse was long remembered by the Jews. Now, in the next chapter, chapter 10, it will be shown that these important historical events could only have occurred in 1 BC. This major Roman-Jewish war that Josephus records took place in the summer and autumn of 1 BC, and it was fought as a result of King Herod's death, because of the killing of the rabbis, and because of the Passover massacre. For this reason, no lunar eclipses beyond the one in the 10th of January 1 BC need be considered as being the eclipse mentioned by Josephus. And the next chapter will demonstrate why this was the case. And so ends chapter 9 of The Star That Astonished the World. Chapter 9 was The Lunar Eclipse of Josephus. I apologize, this is very involved, but we had to get through this.
Yes.
Once again, to show that the other eclipses do not qualify, and that only the eclipse of 1 BC... And remember, this all occurred during the so-called Dark Decade, which is now beginning to open up, and we'll see that during this Dark Decade, there was a major war fought in Judea, around Jerusalem, in which Jerusalem was not destroyed. And this occurred, when Jesus was about 3 years old. And this also probably occurred during the time when they were in Egypt.
In Egypt, yeah.
So that the family of Jesus was actually safe during those several years, during those few years. So we'll see, and this will all come together, and we'll get to some straight narrative about the war, this important but unknown war of Verus. and that we shall see next time.
You know, it's interesting, David, the killing of the rabbis. Barry Chamish has reported that there are an extraordinary number of rabbis recently
that supposedly drive very badly and keep getting into these traffic accidents.
Yeah, and end up dead.
And they happen to be the ones that are opposing the government's moves to, you know, withdraw from the settlements,
right,
which, by the way, were all financed primarily by American money.
Right.
So it's a fascinating situation on there.
And, you know, I kind of see, like, history is repeating itself.
Well, consider the two witnesses.
Oh, yes.
They will very likely be priests.
Yes.
They will be killed in the temple. Mm. And their bodies exposed outside the temple. This is rather clear from, you know, Revelation.
Well, human nature hasn't changed much, and it's very distressing.
I came across an interesting statement in which it says, quote, "History does not repeat itself, but history does rhyme." You know, in other words, the theme is like a musical score. The theme is repeated, and the chorus is repeated time and time again. It's not that exact events repeat themselves, but they occur in a rhythm, in a rhyme, and a repetition. And this is more this makes actually better accord with what Solomon says, that things happen in cycles. It's not like the same things happen, but similar things happen in cycles. So very interesting statement that I came across. I'm going to have to try and track that down.
Yeah.
Who said that and what the concept was behind it. So, no, there's a lot of history, and it can all be verified. That's the key to good history. If you cannot go back and see the logic train as you can with Dr. Martin's material, it's all laid out in front of you. You can check and double check to see if his there's actually very little assumptions. He's just acting, working from the evidence of Josephus and other historical events, dealing with historical characters. You know, the death of King Herod and other things, and the eclipses and that the correct eclipse in 1 BC and the incorrect one that we've dealt with in other ways. So that, you know, you can verify the information. It's like a good scientific theory can be verified and proven, and what's more important, it's disprovable. The evidence is in front of you. Okay, disprove it.
Yeah.
That's a good scientific theory. If it is possible to be disproven, and you cannot disprove it, then the theory has excellent validity. So, people have picked and taken bits and pieces, but you have to consider the whole and all the evidence to understand the picture and the format of this. So, thank you for the opportunity to present this. This is difficult material, but next chapter will be easier and a little more fun.
Well, it's fascinating, and I think, you know, it builds more of a foundation. People need to learn about the history.
Yeah.
And without understanding the history, well, look at our country, David. The young people today do not understand the history of this country.
Right.
Or the history of the world, for that matter. And it's very easy for them to be deceived about a lot of things. So I am a real stickler about history, and I appreciate you taking the time to read through these things and explain them. I think that's very, very useful. Okay, everybody, go to askelm.com. You can read this book for free online. the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And we will begin with Chapter 10 next time. So God bless you, David, and all the listeners out there. Read and study like you have never read or studied before, because things are getting very interesting in the world today. And the more you know, the better armed you are. Good night, everybody.